opaque surface. Ulrich knew from the level of McClintock's voice how tall the man was, and the information from his dossier and various net sites said he was a strikingly handsome man in his early 30s. Ulrich's visual cortex drew a picture that vaguely suggested a vidstar from many years earlier. McClintock knows how to keep his thoughts hidden, Ulrich realized. The man just sits there saying nothing, knowing that he has the power of life and death over the Farside Observatory. Over me, myself. At last he asked McClintock, "Is it absolutely necessary to keep Simpson at Cellini?" McClintock started to reply, hesitated, then answered, "He'll only be there a day or so. If you want Cardenas to help you, we should keep Simpson reasonably close to her." "The man understands nothing," Ulrich thought. Patiently he tried to explain. "With Mr. Henderson incapacitated, I need Simpson here to direct the technical crew. They must take apart the mirror frame so it can be shipped to Dr. Cardenas's laboratory. I need Simpson here to direct them." "Couldn't one of the other—" "No," Ulrich said flatly. "Simpson. He's the only one who can get the job done. The others are not equal to the task. Believe me, I know them well." "None of them?" Struggling to remain calm despite McClintock's obtuseness, Ulrich replied, "You saw how lacking the man Obermann is? I've tried others before him. None of them were competent enough to head the technical team. Simpson is my last hope. Unless I could hire someone else from Cellini, or perhaps even from Earth. But that would be expensive." McClintock said, "You know, Simpson has his own problems. It's rumored that he's a drug user, I know." "And that doesn't bother you?" "Of course it bothers me," Ulrich snapped. "But what choice do I have?" "There's no one else among your entire technical team that can handle the work." "Dolt," thought Ulrich. "I've told the man twice that I need Simpson here, and he still doesn't understand." "Mr. McClintock," he said, very slowly, as if speaking to a child, "you don't seem to realize how limited we are here. I have a mere 50-some engineers and technicians, even less than that now with Henderson out of action. They must run the mirror laboratory, do all the construction work out on the surface, and all the other technical tasks that are necessary. There are another 18 specialists struggling to construct the Cyclops radio telescope array. 18 people. 8 dozen would be barely enough." McClintock shifted in his chair but said nothing. "Cellini's governing council has given us only the barest minimum of funding," said Ulrich. "Which is why you need help from the trust," McClintock said, finally understanding. "Which is why I need help from the McClintock Trust," Ulrich echoed. "Yes." "Well, as I said, Simpson can't be in two places at the same time. He is needed here. He can maintain contact with Dr. Cardenas over phone links." "I suppose so," McClintock said doubtfully. "Then it is settled," said Ulrich. "Simpson returns here at once." Sounding reluctant, McClintock said, "I'll tell him so." "Good." McClintock seemed to understand that he was being dismissed. Ulrich sensed him taking a final sip of his scotch, then getting up from the couch. The professor stood up beside him, barely as tall as McClintock's shoulder. The two men walked to the door and shook hands. "Thanks for the drink," McClintock said unenthusiastically. "You are entirely welcome," said Ulrich with equal warmth. "I hope we can work together fruitfully." "So do I, Professor." McClintock left, and Ulrich slid his door shut, leaned against it for a moment, then threaded his way back to the chair he'd been sitting in. He found his wine glass, drained it, then brushed his fingers along the tabletop until he found McClintock's tumbler. The professor carried both glasses to the dishwasher in the kitchenette. As he slipped the glasses into the half-full machine, Ulrich thought, "Simpson is the key to everything. He's the only one who can get those technicians to do their jobs properly. He may be dependent on the medications he takes, but as long as he gets the job done, I don't care if he eats dogs and drinks vinegar. I need him." The professor went to his desk and sat wearily in its little wheeled chair. He called up the latest data on the Sirius system and told the computer to display it in the audio mode. "Sirius C will begin transit number 38 in 32 hours, 7 minutes, and 14 seconds," the synthesized voice began. The planet will pass across the blazing face of the Dog Star, Ulrich understood. From the minuscule dip in the star's brightness, the planet's size could be calculated to a finer precision. My new assistant, this young woman, Dr. Yost, will do that, he thought. Then he remembered that he had ordered her to report to his office again at 0730 hours. I'd better get to bed, he told himself. Simpson, he repeated silently. He's the key to getting the work done. And McClintock, he's the key to getting the funding to carry out the work. Ulrich shook his head as he began to get undressed. A drug user and a spoiled rich brat. He sighed, thinking that it was almost criminal that the great things he wanted to achieve depended upon such people. Dossier. Jason Maximilian Ulrich. He was born to genteelly impoverished nobility in the Austrian city of Linz, which was famous for the pastry called Linzertort, and for being the childhood home of Adolf Hitler. Tales of the family's bygone splendor filled his childhood, and his father still had enough influence to place young Jason in good schools, because he was bookish and got better grades than his classmates, and because he was pompously proud of his family heritage, but most of all because he was slightly built and physically frail, Jason became a favorite target for the bigger and more rugged boys. He got his revenge against them by consistently being first in his classes, despite occasional swollen lips or bruised ribs. It was at the prestigious University of Vienna that Jason Ulrich turned to the study of astronomy. He had won a full scholarship and started in the physics curriculum, inspired by one of the university's most illustrious alumni, the Nobel laureate Edwin Schrödinger. But astronomy lured him away from theoretical physics. Ulrich fell in love with the study of the stars. Nobel Prizes rarely went to astronomers, he knew, but Ulrich burned with an ambition to be among the rare few who achieved that lofty goal. Alas, reality was very different from his dreams. Ulrich was a gifted teacher, but only an ordinary researcher. A generation of students adored him, some of them going on to outstanding careers in astronomy. Ulrich himself remained virtually anonymous, a slim gray figure in the background, not the forefront, of astronomical research. He was the person to whom his students dedicated the books that made them famous. Then came the accident. He was working with a graduate student, a pretty young Hungarian woman with thick honey blonde hair who was specializing in infrared astronomy at Ulrich's suggestion. She was building a sensitive IR detector and, again at Ulrich's suggestion, using liquid hydrogen for its coolant rather than liquid helium. When she worried about the dangers of the highly flammable hydrogen, Ulrich assured her that the increase in the instrument's sensitivity would be well worth the risk. It wasn't. One fine spring afternoon, as he worked alongside the student, inhaling her lovely perfume, the hydrogen exploded in a searing fireball that burned the student to death and destroyed both Ulrich's retinas. Stem cell therapy could rebuild his burned face, but could not repair the completely destroyed retinas. Neurosurgeons made Ulrich see after a fashion by rewiring his visual cortex so that it could be stimulated by the auditory and tactile centers of his brain. He saw through his ears and his fingertips. He was hailed as a living miracle of medical science. He returned to an almost normal life. The miracle was not perfect, of course. The images his visual cortex drew in his mind were not perfect reproductions of the people and things about him. But he did see that lovely young graduate student in his mind's eye. Saw her afire. Heard her screams every time he closed his sightless eyes. Ulrich exiled himself to the moon. The newly independent lunar nation of Selene was starting a university and looking for top-flight people to fill its faculty. Through old associates, he had very few friends, Ulrich received an invitation to head the astronomy department of the fledgling University of Selene. "We need good men like you, Professor," said one of his former students, who now headed Selene University's selection committee. "Dependable, reliable, the kind of man who can turn out top-notch students." Thus Ulrich traveled to the moon, learned to live underground in the strangely light gravity, walked and talked and existed almost like a normal sighted man, and tried to forget his previous life and sorrows. Then another of his former students, now a